It's All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. After a one-week summer hiatus, we are back to review the week in North Carolina politics, plenty of finger-pointing, and a piecemeal budget process has commenced. Here to discuss are Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation, along with Rob Schofield from the progressive NC Policy Watch. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hey, guys.
Nearly 2 months into a budget impasse that is showing no signs of progress, state lawmakers have started what appears to be a series of smaller budgets. This piecemeal process almost feels like we're hitting the rewind button to about 4 months ago in terms of where things were in the legislative process. These mini budgets, this development, indicates Republicans still cannot override the governor's budget veto and that the governor and leading Republican lawmakers have made no movement in negotiations. Do you think this piecemeal approach is an improvement over where things were or just another step in poor governance? Rob?
I think the latter. I think it's actually been the plan all along for months and months. I think the Republicans have pretty much been planning on doing this. They've never really had any intention of seriously negotiating with Governor Cooper. I mean, really, if you go back to 2016, when Governor Cooper was first elected, there has been basically Republicans at the legislature have been in an attack mode toward him, toward his administration, personal attacks, refusal to really sit down like adults and negotiate this stuff. And this is just the latest exclamation point on that. So I presume this will continue for a while and we'll probably be here all fall.
Aside from the political stuff, and of course, you know, everyone's intrigued with that and the finger pointing and all that, there's a real philosophical difference, you know, with this budget. I mean, the governor has made clear that he wants Medicaid expansion as part of it. The General Assembly has said, we're not interested in Medicaid expansion. Let's talk about other ways to extend health care coverage to folks who are unable to afford it. You know, I don't know whether it's good governance, but and as a matter of fact, I think this piecemeal approach to budgeting, in a lot of ways, from my point of view, is preferable to putting everything in one huge document, hundreds of pages, kind of hard to go through. I like the idea of discussing some of these specific line items in the budget. I think it's more transparent. I think it's more accountable. You know, from that side of it, I think that is a good governance move as far as efficiency and getting all of this done. Because, you know, in a $24 billion budget, there's a lot of stuff in there. What they're addressing are high need, sort of immediate need, things that have wide appeal, you know, to go ahead and get those implemented. But it is a piecemeal budget. In the meantime, we've reverted back to last year's spending, which, you know, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, but in the meantime, there's still other needs and other projects, other programs, other parts of that $24 billion budget spending that are not being put into place.
Meanwhile, a proposal that would return much of a state surplus to taxpayers is advancing through your legislature. As a reminder, the state has about a $900 million surplus presently. That is somewhat of a squishy number, as the budget and the big bottom line are unclear because we don't have a new budget. Regardless, under this proposal, individual filers would stand to get a $125 rebate check. Couples who filed jointly would receive $250 back from that state surplus. Becky, your colleague Mitch Kokai sat in that seat a couple of weeks ago and called this a gimmick. Is there any reason to think that this action would provide a boost to the economy?
I don't know that it provides a boost. I think it sends a message from the leadership in the General Assembly that they understand where the money comes from and have respect for the folks who are earning it and sending it in to Raleigh. You know, I don't know if it's a gimmick or not. You call it whatever you want to, and Mitch is my colleague, and he can certainly call it a gimmick.
But you would not.
I don't know whether it's a gimmick or not. I mean, I think it's a sign that this leadership respects where the tax money comes from. You know, there's worse things they could do with this money than return it to taxpayers. And I think you have to be careful when you get these kind of one-time, non-recurring monies as, you know, to what you can do. You certainly don't want to put that towards recurring expenses that may or may not occur. You know, the money may not be to fund those in following years. So you're kind of limited in what you might do with that money.
Seems inevitable to me that a major storm will hit North Carolina again, be it this fall
or
next
fall.
We can count on it. Or next week. Why not put the vast majority of that money in the rainy day fund?
Well, I mean, that's a thought, too. Now, in this budget that's been held up, there is a lot of money that goes back into that rainy day fund. I think the rainy day fund, when it's fully funded at that $2 billion that they're trying to get back to, and I think the funding in the budget that's being held up gets us just about back to that point. I agree with you. I mean, I think saving is a good idea. I think that's another option of what they could have done with the money.
Yeah, of course, there are desperate needs in just an array of critical services and structures that this money could go toward, and it would really be a drop in the bucket as to what the really need what the need really is. You know what this reminds me of? This really is what you would expect from a party that makes Donald Trump their standard bearer, because it really smacks of sort of like a tip. It sounds like what a casino owner would dish off to employees that are really poorly paid and they're not taken care of and their systems and structures aren't taken care of, but I'll throw them a tip. And that's what this feels like to me. And indeed, it's not even a tip that goes to everybody. It only goes to about two-thirds of taxpayers, because you have to have you're only qualified based on your income tax status. So there's a third of the taxpayers, mostly low-income people, who won't even get it. It's just, I mean, to me, it's another exclamation point on a dreadful session. It's a terrible policy suggestion, and I really hope it doesn't go anywhere.
Finally, justices at the state Supreme Court heard arguments this week about jury selection and racial bias in death penalty cases. Both of your organizations have advocated for some criminal justice reforms, some similar, some different. I'm wondering from each of you, your perspective, what you think the best ruling is that we could see from the high court here.
I mean, to me, it's clear that the Supreme Court needs to rule that these individuals were wrongfully placed back on death row. We're talking about individuals who got relief under the Racial Justice Act, had their sentences converted to life in prison without chance of parole. The legislature came in, repealed the Racial Justice Act, and then they were sent back to death row. There's also some other people who had their appeals pending at the time who were also seeking relief. I mean, to me, it's clear that those individuals need relief. It's a case of double jeopardy. There was blatant racism in their trials, and they need to, at a minimum, have this relief, and it needs to be yet another a nail in the coffin of the death penalty in this state.
Well, of course, it affects a very few number of people. I think it's, what, 6 or 7 individuals who were impacted by this, who
directly
sort of got caught up in that, you know, the change from the law being enacted and then the law being repealed, and, you know, where do they sit in that? So it seems to me, and this is a legal question, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me that if you were granted the deal under one set of circumstances, then that ought to be the deal that you have. I don't know what the courts are going to do. I know there's a tremendous amount of attention on this, and as Rob mentioned, you know, one of the concerns from a lot of areas is that this is a runaround, a way to eliminate the death penalty in North Carolina. And there are concerns about that for people that believe strongly in the death penalty, from those that don't. But, you know, the other question that I think it raises is, are the courts the appropriate place to make those kind of big policy decisions, or are those better made within the General Assembly? So I think there's a lot of questions that are going to arise from whatever the decision is. So whatever the decision is in this case, I think we're still going to be talking about what the ramifications are and, you know, where this ends up and consequences and, you know, what it might mean, particularly for the administration of the death penalty in North Carolina.
Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your holiday weekend.
Thanks, you too.